This podcast is sponsored by Investec for Institutions. With our global network and insights-driven expertise, we deliver seamless execution and tailored services to help you achieve your strategic objectives. Whether you're a pension fund, insurer, asset manager, or hedge fund, the right partner makes all the difference. Partner with Investec for Institutions. Homegrown, world-class, out of the ordinary.
Welcome to this special edition of Money Markets and Masterminds, brought to you in partnership with Investec for Institutions. Today, we're delving into the sophisticated world of institutional investment, exploring how South African pension funds, life companies, asset managers, and hedge funds are navigating shifting markets and how innovative structuring can help. I'm joined by Richard Swain, Head of Institutional Coverage at Investec for Institutions, who has more than two decades of experience across London and South Africa in derivatives, equities and multi-asset solutions. Richard, great to have you here.
Hi, Ryan. Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Before we get into the markets, let's start with your own journey. You began your career on derivatives desks in London, and now you're leading institutional coverage for Investec here in Cape Town. Can you take us through that journey and where some of the turning points along the way that stand out?
Sure. I suppose when anyone ever starts off in a financial services, one doesn't necessarily catapult themselves to the top of the food pile. So I started off in a sort of a very middle office role, working for one of the big American banks in the UK, having completed my studies here in South Africa at UCT. I had an accounting background, but I wasn't too enamored with the prospects of accounting, and I always had markets in my blood. So basically took myself over to London, where I worked in credit and debt derivatives for about 5 years for an American conglomerate, and basically cut my teeth in the world of high finance. Before returning to South Africa post the 1998 Russian debt default crisis, I'm not sure if you remember that major devaluation of the Russian ruble and a default for Russia on some of its domestic and sovereign offshore debt, which led to a large sort of rewriting of the risk rules. In particular, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association needed to go away and have a re-look of what constituted default, etc. Interestingly, technically, the Russians market defaulted again in 2022, obviously brought about by the West sanctions upon them as they invaded the Ukraine. But that basically brought me full circle back into the South African market, where there wasn't that much application for credit derivatives at the time. But I found myself in an equity derivatives role for a French bank based out of Johannesburg, where we basically promulgated the listed equities options technology for them from a sales perspective, predominantly back then into the retail market. One might remember the warrant world of the sort of early 2000s, listed calls and puts on South African shares. And that we brought to market alongside one or two other international operations. The local banks then picked up on that technology through some inward hiring and some external buying of technology and staffing. And one thing led to another. I ended up at APSA, putting together their listed warrant program with a couple of my colleagues as we extricated from the French operation, and then eventually was headhunted by Investec in around about 2005 to do the same for them. Interestingly, after 20 years at the bank, my role has morphed into more an institutional focus, having led the equity derivative sales operation for a number of years. I relocated myself back to Cape Town, where we all know a lot of the money is now being managed in South Africa. Obviously, money management is transient. It can be done from anywhere. And a large number of the local pension funds, life companies, those linked to insurers, the independent asset managers are largely based here in Cape Town. And more recently, we've seen a lot of the hedge funds moving staff and operations down to the Cape. So in a way, we've followed that from a sales perspective, but now we obviously need to be a little bit more nimble. We're not too siloed in our approach. We need to be able to sell a multi-asset execution and structured product capabilities. That's pushed me into a number of different asset classes in terms of what we are able to deliver to the institutional market from an execution point, using our various programs and brokerage licenses into the South African and offshore markets. So essentially a full circle from the Cape overseas, back via Joburg and back to Cape Town.
Let's get to behind the scenes, your day-to-day job. How does Investec for Institutions partner with pension funds, life companies and asset managers to help them to achieve their objectives?
Well, if essentially our function is very much a collaborative meeting of the minds across our various desks. Like I say, I come from a predominantly equities and derivatives-based background, where traditionally we were talking to equity PMs. We all know that the world's gone more multi-asset faceted in its thinking. In fact, case in point would be the recent ASISA data suggesting that almost 50% of local CI structures are now multi-asset in their component. And ultimately, our job is to ensure that where our equities desk might be strong, but our bond desk is not strong with that particular institution, we make sure that there's a cross-pollination of the relationships, and getting one area to introduce the other, introduce one area to another, and effectively hoping that in time we have a better handle of the value of that institution to the bank as a whole. Gone are the days where equities people simply talk to equities people. Around that, we've built a quite a formalized business intuition or BI platform, which gauges a better idea of the net value in terms of revenues booked with that institution, allowing us to service guys a lot better, knowing what their worth is to the bank as a whole.
Richard, for someone who survived not one but two Russian market crises, let's talk about where the markets stand today. We've seen a mix of global headwinds, from shifting US rate expectations to currency volatility and pressure on emerging market flows. Yet local equities have shown pockets of resilience. Richard, how are you reading the current market backdrop as we see it today?
Well, Rena, I think the best way to describe it currently as we stand today is that despite elevated trade uncertainty, geopolitical risk in pockets of the world, risks to US growth and an uncertain interest rate trajectory in the US, global market equity volatility is optically very low. Case in point is that the last 2% daily move for the S&P was back in May. Realized volatility over the S&P over the last 60 days is around sort of 9.5%, which is well below its 20-year median. Same can be said for MSCI World Index over the past 90 days, which is currently around 8%. Implied volatility, that's essentially taking reference to the CBOE Volatility Index, or the VIX, as it's better known. That's essentially measures volatility implied by the price of options on the S&P 500, and that's sitting at around 14, which is a year-to-date low. Volatility levels of fixed income currencies are also down. So that seems quite strange when we consider that in mid-April we had President Trump off on his Independence Day paradigm, suggesting that he was going to effectively try and close down global trade globally. We have the US leading economic index signaling some form of fragility. We have other factors in the US indicating a risk of a contraction in growth, or dare we say it, recession, and that's in the form of consumer at the bottom end, showing pockets of weakness. one refers to Walmart's results the other day, fast food chains, certain retailers printing fairly benign levels of earnings. We've got U.S. hotel occupancy running at sort of one of the worst rates in 25 years. Potential credit card and mortgage delinquency sort of raising its head in the U.S. And then we also need to realize why Trump is perhaps, you know, enacting these policies, and that is that he's quite desperate for a sort of a internally led, you know, onshore manufacturing led growth ideal, which essentially is promulgated by low corporate taxes, low levels of interest rates, and the likes. But some of his policies are hugely inflationary by proxy. One thinks of a clampdown on immigration, tariffs on the rest of the world, which eventually effectively stops the importing of low Chinese deflation. All this in an interest rate environment where he's trying to service a debt bill of all of $36 trillion. Which potentially can grow by $3 or $4 trillion in the next couple of years, just simply on the effects of the outlook to the U.S. deficit based on his own big beautiful bill. So I think it's unsurprising that we're seeing asset classes like gold ticking along $3,500 an ounce. Bitcoin being used as a proxy for risk and sort of being adopted quite widely globally, even now so by U.S. banks who are looking to see whether there's an investment ideal there. But the importance for all of this for South Africa is that ultimately all of this will probably end up in a weaker dollar, which we're already starting to see. That means, strong strength in our South African rand, which has greater implication for our own deficits down the line in a positive way. There's a potential, switch out of U.S. exceptionalism, which has been largely the driving factor in global markets for many years now, perhaps towards late cycle industrial assets. Dare I say it? China might pick up its GDP in the next couple of years, which would lead to a lot more demand for South Africa's resources. Generally, foreigners look at South Africa in a favorable way on a number of fronts. So we have a very stable financial system. We're deemed the gateway to Africa. Our valuations are optically quite low, probably as a function of our own foot faults in terms of what a weak governance has led to in terms of our infrastructure problems in the last couple of years or so. But if we are to ride a reflation in emerging market valuations, we would be very, very well served.
Richard, you mentioned or lightly touched on some of the global developments in rates and forex filtering into local markets, and you touched on some key themes driving South African markets as well. But are you seeing any sector or asset class rotation that institutional investors should be paying attention to?
I think the way to look at that question is to ask, how are the foreigners playing their South African market? And very simply, we've seen a very strong rally in SA government bonds in the last 6 to 9 months, probably on the back of a stronger rand, and probably under the on the back of an expectation to a cut in rates, which would naturally follow a cut in rates in the developed markets. And local equities, I feel, haven't yet felt the influx of foreign interest, barring, dare I say it, one or two key and unignorable sector favorites. And those would be the likes of, let's say, ShopRite, which is probably deemed best of breed in its category. a Capitec, which is largely innovative and has been on an amazing growth run for the last couple of years or so, now branching into digital technologies, fintech. One thinks of an MTN, which seems to be benefiting from a slightly better self-help paradigm in some of its key African markets like Nigeria, Ghana, Rwanda, and the like. Clicks would be another one that comes to mind. Incredibly well managed local operation, which always seems to grow earnings on a regular basis. Perhaps one or two miners, and then of course Naspers, or as the major holder of Tencent, arguably China's most valuable tech asset. So, outside of those shares, we haven't yet seen the foreigners starting to act. And that, I think, can come. But obviously, it will come when they're able to digest what we're starting to see on the ground ourselves. And that is some far better infrastructure thinking, the adoption of public sector partnerships, in particular on our rail networks, a slightly better energy availability factor, as Eskom has been promulgating in the last 6 to 9 months, and evidenced by the fact that we don't have as much load shedding as we used to do, and perhaps a better rail and port stability. Transport Minister Barbara Creasy only last week talking of potential privately owned locomotives on our railway lines next year, which would be wonderful. There are also talks about privatization of our electricity grid. This all takes time. It flows through into better confidence data. It flows through into better PMIs. It flows through into business confidence and ultimately has the ideal to attract foreign capital. So I remain cautiously optimistic that we are in a bit of a waiting game, but that incrementally this small steps are being had, things are looking a lot better than where they were perhaps a year ago.
Richard, let's zoom out and look at institutional behavior. Local pension funds are constantly balancing growth, protection, and liquidity. How are you seeing South African retirement funds shifting allocations across equities, bonds, forex, and alternatives?
Ruan, I think we need to answer that question by going back a couple of years, where certainly pension funds under Reg 28 of the Pension Funds Control Act were only able to invest 30% of their assets offshore. After that was increased to 45% with some concessions towards a slant towards alternatives, alternatives being the likes of private equity, infrastructure assets, and hedge funds. There was quite a large dash for the door to get, access to, greater pools of offshore industries and assets, and perhaps greater diversification. Not all asset managers followed suit. Those sort of more locally scaled tended to stick to the closer to 30-35% allocations under their assumptions and auspices that those offshore markets looked a little expensive. Now, one can suggest under all that I've mentioned, considering what the US is going through, that some of these valuations, which again are premised in the likes of 7 or 8 shares alone, particularly in the AI and tech spheres, May well optically make those offshore markets feel a little bit expensive. So what I'm sensing is that local managers are rethinking the local onshore opportunity. If rates do come down in the US, that's largely supportive for emerging market economies, of which South Africa is certainly starting to look like the best of a fairly ordinary bunch. If we can get growth ticking up locally, if it can start presenting itself in data points, which ultimately will present themselves in better earnings for SA-listed shares, or SA Inc. as we call them, I think there will be more of a rotation, and I think it will happen on quite a rapid basis. The caveat to all of that, of course, is that the U.S. markets are largely the innovators of the world. Their recent earnings season seemingly suggests that these earnings do justify some fairly lofty valuations. Look, the Chinese markets are also starting to turn around. There's a feeling that their GDP can come right if they're able to manage their housing issues. Their households look largely cash flush and seemingly have started to employ some of that cash into their own local markets. China, through its own AI ambitions, notably DeepSeek and some of the announcements they made this year, are showing the world that they have as good, if not better, artificial intelligence technology that can convert into big earnings upgrades in the markets that they service. Ultimately, China is also becoming a great innovation hub. I think we all remember, you know, the old paradigm that the U.S. Engineers, the East manufactures and Europe regulates. I think that's starting to change. So all said, possibly a fairly global sense that U.S. markets feel a little full. Europe seems to be on the recovery somewhat. China looks like it can turn itself around, which would be great for all emerging markets in terms of where they demand their resource inputs from. And SA can ride along the coattails.
Richard, how do institutions weigh the appeal of innovation in such structured products that you just referenced against the need for liquidity, governance, and fiduciary responsibility?
I think the way to answer that is that institutional investors balance innovation in structured products with their fiduciary duty by undertaking very rigorous due diligence effects, prioritizing transparency, ensuring the suitability of products for their beneficiaries. It's important to realize that while innovation seeks enhanced returns or unique risk exposures, the fiduciary responsibility demands that investors act with prudence and loyalty to protect the beneficiaries' best interests. So the foundation of that is premised on, you know, essentially balancing that innovation with a robust and repeatable due diligence process. And key considerations there would be, you know, including understanding the complexity of structured products. Structured products can combine traditional debt with derivatives. They can have relatively complex risk and return profiles. Fiduciaries must fully comprehend features like barriers or participation rates, and perhaps how they interact with you know, before investing. Like I've just mentioned, assessing the issuer is important. Structured products are typically unsecured debt obligations of the issuing bank, so the issuer's creditworthiness is a primary risk factor. So there, you know, that would require a thorough analysis of the issuer's financial stability and credit rating. Testing performance scenarios is important. Trustees must model how a structured product would perform under a variety of market conditions, including adverse or unanticipated events. And that stress testing basically helps them to understand the potential impact on their overall portfolios. So I would say key practices are, you know, getting a little bit more granular. They would be demanding clear documentation, you know, insisting on comprehensive prospectuses and offering circulars that detail all terms, risks and costs associated with a product, being vigilant for any potential conflicts of interests, making sure that issuers or brokers are not necessarily profiting more than the end investor, and that's largely encapsulated in the huge amounts of regulation that is required to be met. Addressing hidden costs, any fees and commissions on structured products must be easily discernible. We are very transparent about what we've built in for our structuring fees. And overall, ensuring that any product's suitability suits the ultimate best interests of the beneficiary. What we mean is that it must meet an investment mandate, which is set up around that risk tolerance for each particular beneficiary. That should pretty much do the trick.
Richard, you lightly touched on the recent Regulation 28 reforms and the impact it had on institutional demand for offshore and alternative strategies. But looking at your international background, what lessons can South Africa still take from more mature markets in balancing liquidity, governance, and fiduciary considerations?
Well, I think one needs to look at the extreme depth and liquidity of the global derivative markets to understand that they are far more mature and user friendly and adopted than perhaps they are locally. Ultimately, our regulators are very fast coming up to speed with international best practice. We have the Financial Services Conduct Authority, which promulgates notices such as Board Notice 90, which effectively is starting to govern or has been governing what asset classes, what securities, what levels of gearing, what levels of exposure, diversification, etc., can be carried inside CIS portfolios. But we also need to realize that those markets overseas have grown dramatically because the application for these products is far better understood over there. So it's going to take some time, but ultimately, if we fall back on the paradigm that indexation over time generally outperforms. In particular, in non-volatile periods like we're going through right now, that these products simply just can't be ignored forever. So once all the risks are understood, importantly, the education job, in particular at the level of the trustee, has been done well, and the confidence factor builds, then the uptake in products like this will certainly get a little better.
Richard, we've looked into your past. We kind of touched on the present, but let's look ahead. What role do you see technology playing in your process? And how are clients' demands evolving? Are we moving beyond plain vanilla equity exposures to more customized risks managed portfolios?
Ryan, you're starting to chat about now the effect of artificial intelligence, which has had a major effect on risk modeling in the last couple of years, and in particular in the ambit of electronic trading. Basically, it's we've moved from a backward-looking, human-driven analysis to a proactive, real-time, and data-intensive approach. AI's ability to process vast, diverse data sets and identify complex patterns effectively enhances risk detection and mitigation, but can also introduce new challenges. How would one think of AI, if that's the question you're asking in terms of, portfolio management, or let's start with the basics of trading. you know, AI systems in processing these vast amounts of data are able to continuously monitor market fluctuations, asset movements, global events, and that allows them to make, you know, fairly instantaneous insights into potential threats. This allows investors to react to market shifts and mitigate risks far more quickly than you know, traditional human-led monitoring. The advanced predictive analytics that's now available to us, you know, using machine learning, allows AI to analyze extensive, you know, historical markets and alternative data. You know, one thinks of looking at news sentiment, social media, to potentially forecast potential price movements and market volatility with greater accuracy. You know, this allows traders to set more precise stop order limits, you know, and optimize their risk to reward ratios. Yeah, I think these type of systems can simulate far broader range of hypothetical market scenarios, which is important. Whether these systems can anticipate unanticipated moves. Now, this is where the technology becomes a little bit questionable, and that is in the event of, let's call it, a black swan event, which traditionally is an unforeseen effect on markets, like COVID perhaps was. It's difficult to test how a portfolio would perform under extreme stress when something as unanticipated as COVID had come along. But ultimately, that's up to the intuition that's been built into this modeling to be able to understand going forward. And then I think I must talk on how it perhaps started. You know, we're talking, there are major new services in the world, and we know who they are, and they sort of sit on all traders' desks. These guys are employing things like natural language processing, where the AI bots sift through news articles, social media, and various reports to gauge market sentiment. So these type of interrogative strategies can allow investors to pick up early signals, potential market shifts that may not be immediately reflective in current prices. So we live in a very exciting world. We obviously are very aware that we can't allow the machines to take over in their entirety, but the simple data processing capability is there, you know, that has potential to change the way we do things dramatically in the next 5 to 10 years.
Speaking of which, Richard, and my last question for today, if you could just drag your crystal ball a bit closer, what does the future of multi-asset solutions look for South African pension funds, or what would you like it to look like for South African pension funds?
Ruan, I think a large education job still needs to be effected. Explaining what we deem to be fairly simple products to pension and fund investors is not going to be an easy task, because they're very, you know, set in their ways in terms of how they've traditionally you know, enacted their investment ideals through due diligence process on single manager strategies. But like I say, we are starting to see pockets of interest coming through from, let's call it, university endowment programs, which I suppose by their nature might be a little bit more inquisitive by their function. We're starting to see risk consultants, you know, big risk consultants, come to us to ask the questions around what we can do in passive-esque payoffs that effectively provide to them a tool that does what it says on the box. At importantly, a far lower total expense ratio than perhaps would some active strategies. We're starting to see people push themselves, you know, up the risk curve in terms of being able to link credit to equity, which was quite a large step away from the simple, you know, FX acts linked fixed outperformance of 4 or 5 years ago. So I think it comes down to, you know, the trustees and the managers themselves understanding the baseline risks, then making themselves comfortable with how we are able to structure them into hybrid instruments, making sure that our compliance and their compliance is rock solid in terms of how it meets the regulatory guidance and ambits of the factors that are governing what we can and can't do, and building confidence, showing that over a track record of 3 to 4 years, which is usually the sort of term to maturity in most of these notes, that that effectively these products can give the type of returns that they are mandated to do, and therefore are able to form part of the investable universe on a more sustainable basis of institutional investors like funds like this.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Richard, thank you for sharing your personal journey, giving us a clearer read on the markets and unpacking how Investec for Institutions is working with pension funds and asset managers to navigate complexity with tailored solutions. This has been Money Markets and Masterminds, brought to you in partnership with Investec for Institutions. If you'd like to learn more about Investec structuring and institutional capabilities, visit their website at investec.com or speak to their team directly. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is sponsored by Investec for Institutions. With our global network and insights-driven expertise, we deliver seamless execution and tailored services to help you achieve your strategic objectives. Whether you're a pension fund, insurer, asset manager, or hedge fund, the right partner makes all the difference. Partner with Investec for Institutions. Homegrown, world-class, out of the ordinary.